Welcome back to the Chaos West stage. I just saw that in my notes, that it's in English. I'm very sorry. So on my other screen, I'm already seeing Jennifer. And Jennifer is talking today to us about building less inaccessible websites. I'm sure many of you, because most of us are probably hackers, are building some form of websites in their spare time or for some organization or whatever. And one point that's often missed is, or that many people don't really think about, is that not everyone is able to use your website like you might be able to. And luckily, there are many technologies to improve the usability for people that cannot use the websites like we do. So Jennifer is talking to us today about what's possible there. And yeah, I would just hand it off to Jennifer now, if you might.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, hello. I'm here today in my own apartment, whatever, to talk to you about building less inaccessible websites for nostalgia's sake, and because, well, my talk was lacking images. I've got some photos from last year's Congress. They aren't that important. Okay. So, I've never spoken in front of such a large and simultaneously slow amount of people, so bear with me if I'm a bit too fast or something. I apologize already. I've got these captions on. If I'm not funny, at least they might give me a laugh or something. So yeah, what's the motivation?
So I'm quite sorry, we seem to be having some audio issues. In the background, we are fixing them for some reason. The mic just stopped working for us. But Jennifer is fixing it in the background. I'm very sorry, we'll just start the talk again once those issues are fixed. But maybe it's now a good time to remind you that, yes, it's a remote Congress. Everything's a little bit different, but there are some rules that might still apply to you. For example, the 621 rule, if you don't know that. Really, please keep in mind 6 hours of sleep, 2 meals a day, 1 shower. That really helps a lot. I know that if you're at home, it's a little bit hard because, you know, you're sitting there and nobody really cares about how you're looking anyways, but do yourself the favor, keep care of yourselves. And also make sure that after the talk, you bring back your empty bottles to the bottle drop point in your location, wherever you might are. And yeah, seems that still we're not getting any audio. Let me quickly see if there's maybe another microphone that we can activate instead of the headset. Jennifer, could you please take a look if there's any other microphone maybe? Maybe even the built-in one. So we're still frantically trying to fix it. But yeah, technical problems everywhere. I mean, this is really amazing that it's even possible to have these talks at all. And I think I'm getting some audio now.
Okay.
So it's a little bit quiet. I'll have to do some adjustments on my side. I'll quickly fix that for you. Speak again, please.
Yes. Testing.
Okay. Yep. It seems to be that you're audible again. And I'll switch back to the other slides and let you maybe start again from the beginning. And let's continue.
Yes. I apologize for that. I had not anticipated it. I turned off the captions. Maybe there's some issue with multiple tabs using my microphone or something. So I'm sorry about that. So let's try this again.
Today I want to talk to you a bit about building less inaccessible websites. Not very important things there, because it's a bit, make your blog better, apparently. So let's get started. What's my motivation for this, or what should your motivation be for making your websites less inaccessible? It's a somewhat general rule that I try to apply to most interactions and most stuff I do. It's to not be an asshole. But probably your boss won't be happy to hear that if you've got one. So here's some bit nicer words. If you improve your accessibility, you will obviously be able to have more customers because disabled people use the internet too. And they will also talk about what they are using. So if you're more accessible than your next competitor, that's also a great point, and it also helps you a lot if you're less accessible. There's also the curb effect, meaning that UX improvements for people with disabilities will usually help everyone. Not all of them will, but generally speaking, it's just great UX for most people who use your site. And also search engine optimization. Google takes care to mostly rank pages that are somewhat accessible highly. And overall, it's comparatively little effort to improve on any of these factors. So that may be a reason to get started. What's the scope for this talk? Because accessibility is a huge topic, and I obviously can't talk about all of it. What I want to do today is kind of give you some place to start if you haven't considered accessibility yet, or if you just don't know what to do with your current site. So I will talk a bit about general rules, about where to start and this metaphorical low-hanging fruit. And then I also say what you should avoid when you're building new things. Then I'll be talking a bit about semantic HTML, which is something that will help your accessibility a lot. And I will just tell you a bit about the basics so that you once again have a point to get started. If what you want to communicate can't be communicated using semantics, you may use ARIA. That's does not have anything to do with Nazis. It stands for Accessible Rich Internet Applications. And I will show a couple of ARIA tags and tell you what they're for and how to use them. Then some nice to haves, like questions you can ask yourself if you get to change a lot or if you're starting to open a new project. These are things that can generally be implemented in already existing projects. And at the end, I will give you a bit of an intro to how to test the accessibility of your site. Some general rules are like the most important thing is to listen to user preference. You should not force specific fonts. You should not force specific sizes. You should definitely not prevent zooming. And please don't implement smooth scrolling. Browsers come with smooth scrolling, and if people disable it, they disable it because they don't want it for whatever reason. Maybe low power device, maybe motion sickness. Please don't implement that yourself. It will also break. If you're listening to the audience, that's a point to get started, but you should also consider the principle of power. So if you can build something with HTML and CSS, don't use JavaScript for it. That's because accessibility isn't just about disability. It's also about people with older or slower hardware, bad internet connections, and generally JavaScript will perform worse. And it will also increase your page size, probably. And once again, internet traffic isn't free, so you should decrease your page size. And one thing that I think is important is that load on the server side is generally better than load on the client side, because if you've got your template that is prepared, you can usually cache it for multiple users. And if it's made on the front end, you can only cache it once, or every user has to compile it at least once. So also, we've got these servers that are made for it, and you never know what devices your users are having. So if you can, move your load to the server side. Some more. Where to begin? You've already got something. First things first, very easy to check. Do you have a lang attribute on your HTML tag? That will tell screen readers how to pronounce it and give you a couple of other neat improvements, and it's really no hassle to do. And if you mix languages, did you know that you can add a lang attribute not just to the HTML but to any tag? So let's say you're building a social network and people are writing posts in whatever languages. You can theoretically give any post a tag with the language that it is written in, and screen readers will know how to pronounce it. Then another thing that's quickly to check and to fix is, do all of your images have an alt text? Yeah, there are some fluff images that don't need one, but well, you need those images because they will also increase your page footprint, and you should consider it if you really need them. Also, if you're localizing your site, are you localizing the alt text? Because I've seen sites that don't, and it's kind of a shame because it's really not that much of an additional hassle. Another thing, do all inputs have an associated label? This serves multiple purposes. A screen reader will know what to tell someone when they're activating some input, so they will know what they have to enter. And also, if you click on a label, usually the input will be activated. That means people who have issue clicking on small text or whatever, or if they're on mobile and in touch is always a bit more difficult, they've got a larger space that they can interact with. And generally, it's also not too difficult because usually you will already have some text saying what people should input. And if that text is the placeholder, you should also reconsider that, because placeholders will often not be translated by website translation tools. So that might break some usability for some people. And the label is just better because maybe someone entered something and then a placeholder goes away and they forget what they're doing because they've got a short attention span or any other number of issues. Do you have a meta viewport tag? And if you've got one, is it a good one? I've got this very basic one on the slide visible. You can use the meta viewport tag to prevent zooming and to salvage your beautiful pixel perfect design. However, you should not do that. People change those settings for a reason. And a last thing, do all links and buttons contain useful text? So if it's just an icon, a bit difficult if you can't read, or if you can read but can't see the icon for whatever reason. So links and buttons should contain text that actually says what they do. Some more things that you could ask yourself with your existing project is, what color contrasts are within the main page content? So like your blog posts or whatever. There are automatic testing tools that can tell you where you are missing the mark. And generally, there's the standard WCAG AA, which you should strive for meeting. AAA is also good, but it severely limits what colors you can use. So AA generally is a good midway point. Do you use color alone to convey information? Because if you do, don't. There are many reasons why people will not be able to see that color. And if something is important, just tell them this is important or this is wrong. Don't just color something differently. What fonts are you using? It's another thing. because Sans fonts are generally more accessible. Serif fonts may merge into one another and just are more difficult to read. And if another thing considering the fonts is, do you really need to download external fonts, or can you just use some generic font family that people already will have? Because having to download a font costs a bit of data, and also it may fail, and the site may not look the way you want, or maybe it's slow and you get a flash of unstyled text, and probably even a layout shifting, which is pretty bad if you're trying to read something and then what you're reading suddenly is somewhere else. Another thing that's quick to implement is a jump to content and jump up button. The jump to, skip to content button usually is some invisible link as the very first element on your site that will only become visible once it's focused. And it will allow people to skip the navigation to just get to the juicy bits. It's not strictly necessary, and I will tell you a bit more about why and what you can do instead. But it's nice to have, and very little effort. It's like just a tiny bit of CSS to hide something that's not focused. So you've did all that. You've got it started. Now you're really motivated to do better in the future and avoid new pitfalls. And what are those pitfalls? This is like the first one is like a personal favorite of me. It's icon fonts, because we see this wonderful Google Calendar header here. We've got some search and help and settings icons, and this happens when I force a font. I can't tell what those icons used to mean. It's interesting that two of these icons still work, and this is definitely not the worst example of this there is. So it's actually rather common that websites are not usable because icons just don't work when you force another font. Also, icon fonts aren't screen reader accessible, because what should the screen reader pronounce here? It's usually some very high character code that just doesn't have an associated pronunciation. And you should definitely hide them to prevent screen readers from saying stuff that you don't want them to. So that's the ARIA hidden true tag for that. They often cause a flash of unstyled text, once again, and layout shifting, especially if you've got a large set of icons that have to be downloaded. Obviously, they can be cached, but it's better to not include them. Also, these days, if you don't have to support Alt Internet Explorer, which also is an accessibility thing, because yes, some people are forced to use Alt Internet Explorer, but if you're thinking about that, generally, having to support these old browsers will hurt everyone who's got a newer browser, because it's just most of the time not worth it. Most browsers these days can display inline SVG, so you can just use SVG icons. If you're not going for a serious look, how about emoji? Because screen readers will know how to pronounce emoji. And they are already on most systems, so you won't have to fight for this. Also, you've got your cool inline SVG icons included, and you're really happy, but you should still not use them to convey meaning alone, because cultural differences or whatever may mean that someone doesn't understand what this icon is trying to tell them, or maybe they don't render for whatever reason. Generally, it's just a good idea to also add explanatory text. If your layout doesn't allow it, because you've got to have this very small search button or whatever, at least add an explanation text that is only visible to screen readers. It's also a rather small CSS rule to add that, so that this text will not be seen but pronounced. What more to avoid? you fix your contrast, you're really happy, but now you've got black text on a white background, or pure black text on a pure white background. That can cause issues as well, because it's especially when you have to stare at it for a long time, it will cause slight visual hallucinations, some bit of movement, maybe flickering, especially for dyslexic users. Using just slightly gray tones instead will fix that, and it won't actually be too obvious. So it probably will look the same, but you've still got this added accessibility while still being able to meet AAA standards if that's what you're striving for. Yeah, once more, layout reflows, they are caused by more than just flashes of unstyled text, and they should definitely be avoided. As I just said, if you're reading something and then suddenly it's somewhere else, that is bad for everyone. Excessive motion, does your website really need motion at all? And if it does, you should listen to the browser tag that tells you if users prefer to not see it, because there is a setting that people can set, and if they've got motion sickness issues, they will, if they know about it, they will set it, and you can use these people. Also blinking, something that generally serves little purpose and makes it harder for people with photosensitive epilepsy. From what I've read in preparation to this talk, flashing at 15 to 25 hertz will trigger seizures in most people with photosensitive epilepsy. So if you've got to have flashing, it's a good rule to stay below a frequency of 15 hertz. However, other flashing frequencies can still trigger seizures, although less likely, and there's lots more factors like what color you're using, how long is the flashing shown, and how large is it. So generally, it's easiest to just avoid blinking at all. Even more stuff to avoid. Removing the underline from links. That's a trend that somehow people use because they want their text to look uniform, but those links are underlined for a reason, because people want to know that something is interactive. They will want to know that it will take them to a different page, and if it's underlined, they will be used to this being a link, so they know what to expect. If you really have to remove the underline, at least color them differently. There is an WCAG standard for the minimum contrast between link color and text color, so you should need that, so links stand out at least. Also, another thing, imagine you're showing people your amazing, cool new project, and then someone hits the tab key, and now there's some ugly blue rectangle in your page, and you don't want that because you spend so much time on the design. So you just add a CSS rule to remove that focus indicator, so your design is salvaged, but don't. It's there for a reason. It's there to tell keyboard users what they're currently interacting with. You can also style it differently, but I would just leave it as is, because people will maybe have their own browser styles so that it always looks the way they expect it to. And just leave the focus indicator as is. It won't hurt the design that much. Generally, relying on this pixel perfect design or whatever, it's not a good idea, because it will break even without assistive technologies, but with assistive technologies, it will definitely break. You will never know what kind of browsers people are using, how their sites are rendered or anything. So you just shouldn't rely on that design, because a broken design can mean that your otherwise good contrast isn't good anymore, because text is white text is overflowing on a white background or anything. It's not a good idea. Long lines of text are another thing that are difficult for people with dyslexia or with short attention spans. It's a good rule to just limit your lines to 75 characters. I've got a little CSS thingy there. for how you can do it. This will mean that your text will be more legible to people with dyslexia. Another thing, long uninterrupted paragraphs are difficult to read for most people, but if you've got dyslexia or ADHD or any other of a number of other disabilities, it will just make your site unusable. And absolute units generally should be avoided because people can set the default text size. And if you set your text size as percentages, it will scale with what they have set as the default, which generally is good if you have low vision and you have got your browser set up to have really large text. Okay, so we know a bit what to avoid, we know a bit where to start checking out our website and what we can do. So let's talk a bit about the basics of semantic HTML. Only the very basics, although it isn't that difficult a topic, it's not the main scope of this talk. So yeah, I will just show a bit and So yeah, let's look at this generic startup website that I've got here as an example. We've got a small navigation, then we've got our main content, a large cookie warning, and a footer. Obviously, visual pages look different because they've also got content and head and body, but this is just a small snippet to illustrate it. This is a site that will look identical. You will see the colored in tags. Here we only have div and span. Here we've got a large number of different tags that all mean something. We've got our nav tag as a container for the navigation, then the links are in an ordered list. Then we've got the main tag for page content. We've got an article, which is which doesn't just mean like a blog post or anything, but an article is anything that can stand on its own. So anything with a kind of like a heading and text or something. So a blog or a post on social media would be an article too, for example. We've got our H1 as a start, and then we've got an H2 within the article. It's important that those H numbers actually count down, and there should only be one H1 because yes, they changed the size, but that's not their main purpose. Their main purpose is to be a heading, and you can change the size in CSS. So please use those responsibly. Then we've got a footer, why you should use the H1 and so on responsibly is because there's a thing called the accessibility tree, which is a list of all the main parts of your site that people can just see and decide where to jump to. So especially if they're using a screen reader, it will be really annoying if every single page will have the navigation web out because they only want to read some article. So let's compare the two snippets. We've got a bit less lines of HTML, but those lines are longer because everything's got class names in the bad snippet. But also, in addition to having longer lines, you will also need CSS to just make sure a heading looks like a heading, a list looks like a list, or whatever. And JavaScript is necessary just to click on the navigation links. All of that isn't an issue with the somewhat semantic snippet, which also definitely is not perfect. As I said, without the accessibility tree that comes with using those page layout tags, screen readers will have to read all of the page, code is difficult to read, in my opinion, for the bad snippet. So less accessibility for your peers who may have to also work on the website. And also the bad snippet will rank rather low on search engines, and Google likes it if you're somewhat semantic or the more the better. So the page layout tags, which you've just seen, are like the easiest to implement because generally you will just have to change divs and spans to more useful tags. Those usually don't come with default styles, so it won't actually change your site too much to use those tags. As I said, screen readers can jump between those tags. And there's also special browsers that just don't render DOM. And these browsers will rely on article tags, for example, to know what to show. Just as I said a minute ago, you never know what browsers people will be using. And generally, yeah, it doesn't add much complexity to your source code. Then links. HTML provides links and buttons. Many people don't seem to know this these days because they build their own and they fail spectacularly. Common reasons for failing are only setting on-click handlers. That means the links won't be usable with the keyboard, or maybe they are usable with the keyboard in theory, but you can't focus them using tab because they don't have a tab index. Spam is usually not terrible. Or it's got a tab index, but it's a wrong one, so that the order of elements, the visual order of elements, isn't the tab order, which is something you should definitely avoid. Also, another thing that I've come across is forgetting to add handlers to lazy loaded content. So I've got a site that works rather well. I can navigate using my keyboard, but then some more content gets loaded and suddenly all the links only work when I click on them because for some reason it was just forgotten and no one bothered to check if this still works. Built in links and buttons work quickly, they perform well, and they work without JavaScript, so they're good. And they also work as expected if the user may have set different interaction keys. So maybe they've got issues hitting the enter key, so they they've got something else set to it, and you generally only listen to the key code, which won't be changed if users remap their interactivity. Generally, considering links and buttons, use what the spec gives you. Maybe if you really need it, add some more JavaScript functionality afterwards, but you usually don't need to do that. Inputs. HTML, and especially HTML5, contains lots of different input types, and these are just a few that I have used in practice and that I really like. Which is color, color, which gives users a color picker, date, time, obviously, and email, which I think is really useful because of two reasons. A mobile keyboard will replace the return key with an add key, usually, if the input type is an email, so people don't have to search for that. And if you've got an actual HTML form, it will not be able to be submitted if the email is wrong. And that regex generally is a pain to write. You still got to check the emails on server side, obviously, but yeah, usually just look if there's an ad in there, and if it is, it will probably be okay. And yeah, if it isn't, they won't be able to use double opt-in or whatever, so it's not that big. So there's tons of really useful input types, and you can check caniuse.com, which is a site I really like, to just see if a specific input type is available on all the browsers that you have to support. And a bit of a personal plea, don't use the range input type. It will give you a slider to input numbers. It's not very usable, it's not very accessible. It's a pain to have some specific number that you want to select, and a simple number with lowest and highest available values will work just fine and probably also look better. Range is also a pain to style using CSS because every browser's got their own way to show it, and yeah, let's just not go there, ignore that simple topic. Browser support is good these days, unless you have to support all the IE, you usually don't have to worry about it too much. And these are usually just preferable to bring your own, because if you want a date, you may have to open use JavaScript to open a window where people can click on a calendar that you have to write yourself, or use some jQuery UI. That's what usually people have for this, which doesn't perform too well and doesn't really work on mobile. And also, it's not what users are accustomed to, because the more sites use the HTML inputs, the more people will know them and know what to expect when a specific kind of keyword pops up or pop up or whatever. It will look the way they want it to, or their browser manufacturers want it to. So yeah, it will generally be better. And you also don't have to worry about making those accessible, because if it isn't, if the browser has implemented it in a bad way, that's generally, people can use a different browser to browse your site, but they can't use a different site to browse your site. So yeah, obviously. As I just said, a form can't be submitted with an invalid value entered. Still do server-side validation, because anyone can still push whatever data they want. It will just be a bit of usability if someone entered like a dot in, a comma instead of a dot at the end of the email address, they will be told. And, you will save a round trip to your server and JavaScript code. So there's loads more of semantic HTML stuff to talk about, but I will leave it at this and move over to Aria. So that's a bit polemic, the first sentence here. They are not really for when, they kind of are for when semantic HTML fails you. Reasons for that include the inability to change tags in legacy projects. Like, you can't just change something to a header, because you will never know what other things it will change. Interactively changing page content is just something that HTML wasn't made for. Also, design choices, you don't get a say in like multiple inputs with the same label. If you are working with other people and those people get to decide that stuff, you can still salvage some accessibility using ARIA tags. Backwards compatibility to HTML4, meaning, yeah, a bit more old browsers will be able to use your site if you've got to support them. And it's also usually a bit quicker to salvage some accessibility using those tags rather than rewriting HTML. So the first ARIA thing to talk about is an attribute that doesn't actually start with ARIA. It's the role. There are loads of roles. Just check out the MDN page for that. MDN. Roles were mostly introduced before HTML5 semantic tags have been used. So if you don't have to support all browsers, using a semantic tag is still preferred. However, roles also change the default values for other ARIA attributes for container. So something that doesn't have a semantic tag is fast when I was looking alert. So the role alert will set the value of ARIA life, which is something I'll talk about in just a minute, to assertive. So that's a bit of a plus, but you should also redundantly also add that rule, just to be sure, because you never know, maybe browsers implemented differently. I've got a rule here for some alerts that site hopefully would not pop up. Useful to add accessibility without risking layout changes. I once had a site I maintained where a totally wrong tag was used for headings, tag that was just not actually available where it was used. So I changed it to a span with a row heading, because I just didn't have time to do all those things that I should make sure the site doesn't look completely. Then, in my opinion, like the most important feature of ARIA is live regions. ARIA Live is used to tell screen readers when to announce changes to your site content. Options are assertive, polite, and off. Assertive means that the screen reader will stop whatever it is saying to announce any changes to the content. So that's like a really important thing that you need the user to know now. Polite means it will finish what it's saying and then jump to whatever it has changed, and off, which is the default if you don't set it, will just not announce any changes. Just like in personal conversations, usually it's just best to try to be polite. ARIA Relevant, in addition to ARIA Live, is used to tell screen readers what to announce. So the options are additions, removals, text, and all, which can also be combined using a space separate list. So additions means every time something adds to is added to your live region, it will be announced. Removals, obviously, the inverse. Text means if any text within your live region will be changed, that will be announced. All is equivalent to all, and the default is that additions and text will be announced. So you don't always have to set this if that's what you want. ARIA Atomic is very useful, but it's good to know about. It tells the screen reader whether or not to announce the whole region if something changes, which could get annoying with a large container that contains lots of text and only like little line at the end is added. Default value is false. In general, you want to keep it as false, but still it's there if you need it. ARIA controls is used to associate an interactive element with live region. It isn't too well supported in screen readers because it supports a space-separated list of IDs for multiple live regions controlled by the same control. But if you think about it, what should a screen reader do in this case? It can only say one thing at a time. So yeah, the software support is low. I've read a very angry blog post saying that this attribute is shit and should definitely not be used. I disagree a bit because putting it in there won't hurt accessibility usually. Yeah, it's not true, it doesn't add any complexity or anything. I've got some simplified example here because these live regions are difficult. Obviously, the site would not work the way it is, but yeah, I want to show just a bit. We've got some search box, and I've realized a mistake. The ARIA controls should be on the button and not on the input. I'm sorry for that. So yeah, we've got a search thingy. People can enter what they want to find. And then we've got the search results. And inside the search results, there is a live region. And this live region is polite, so when I hit the button, an AJAX call will usually just fetch the results. Once it's done, screen reader will probably announce it, unless it's currently saying something else. Everything is relevant, so yeah, if for some reason you search something and the results are less, but a subset of what was previously there, it will tell you. Yeah, so that's basically the gist of those live regions. Some nice-to-haves when you can change a lot, questions you should ask yourself. Copy designs generally or often include low contrasts. If you get to change them, maybe you could, because it's not as important as the page content, but it's still a good thing to have a high contrast with new property design. do you really need that front-end framework that you just read about some cool Hacker News article about? Because those usually aren't too accessible, and they also often have client-side rendering, which I don't like, which has accessibility. And yeah, maybe you can just do it with Vanilla.js. It will be quicker, and yeah, it will probably not look as good on your CV, but that's about the only downside. Is following the latest front-end design trend really that important to you? A couple of years back, Avery cited Parallax, which looks cool in my opinion. It looks so cool that whenever I encounter it, I spend a couple of minutes fiddling with the zooming, then I forget why I visited the page and close it up. Not too great. Maybe just having somewhat plain sight is better for your users and you, because you don't have to implement some great new thing that you will have to remove in a couple of months because it's out. Then another thing, can you make your site work without requiring any JavaScript? Not always possible. Like if you're making a single page application, obviously making that work without JavaScript will be difficult. But if you can, do it and then add on functionality using JavaScript later. So the site should be usable, but maybe some fancy things will still happen when people have access to it. And if this applies to you, maybe ask yourself if your dev team should probably be a bit more diverse, because a more diverse background in your developers will mean they will find more issues and you will end up with a better result for everyone. Next, how do I test? This is obviously, once again, not everything you can do, but a quick way to start tabbing through your website and using the website just without touching your mouse is a good start. Because if you can reach every element, if you can do everything that your website does, it's a good sign that your website will work rather well with assistive technologies. Using a Chromium-based browser, you can run Google Lighthouse, which will give you lots of audits, including many accessibility audits. Meeting 100% in Lighthouse does not mean your site is accessible. It just means your site is not as inaccessible as it would be if it didn't need it. You will still have to do other testing, but it's still, in my opinion, a very good tool. And you can also include it in a CI workflow so that pull requests can't be merged if they reduce the accessibility score or something. Checking the contrast for all elements, especially, once again, the main content, is a good thing. Firefox has an accessibility inspector that works really well for this. You can hover over every element and see the contrast ratio and what standard it does or doesn't need. I really like that. And there are also web extensions that simulate different kinds of color blindness. Trying them out can be really, really interesting to just see if your site is usable to people with those kinds of color blindness. Then you did a bit of testing. Now it's time to ask your users to test, but only if they're into, obviously. You can add, just like with security, you can add an accessibility page to your website, write down every measure you've taken to improve accessibility, admit to known issues, and what you're doing to fix them, which also gains you a bit more trust and will make people more likely to actually submit any issues they have found because they know you care. Provide an accessibility email address and actually read it and fix the issues that people send you. Also provide some kind of reward if you can. Maybe just ask them if they want you, their names written somewhere in credits or whatever, or a monetary compensation if you're able to give it, is always good. So the last things that you can do are more applicable to a corporate environment or to side projects that you take the time to do, lots of time, because navigating your site with the screen reader takes time, and you will have to learn that. But it's also extremely valuable to be able to. macOS is voiceover integrated, and it's rather easy to use. It only takes a few button presses. I'm not too biased towards it, however. There are definitely other screen readers for free or paid. However, some of them may be a bit more difficult to use. So I tried using Orca once, and I couldn't get it to work with Firefox, and there seemed to be a bit of some known issues. If you're using a Mac, like many front-end developers are, just trying out VoiceOver once every couple of versions may be a good idea. And if you can afford it, pay disabled people to do QA for you. It will obviously get you the most valuable feedback, because if they're in some position where their job is to do QA, they will find more than people who just are doing what they personally want to do on your website. However, different disabilities still require different accommodations. A single person will never be able to find everything. And if your blind user says this page is amazing, but your dyslexic user can't use it, that's not too bad. So yeah, but that's a good thing if you can afford it. Some last remarks. I'm obviously far from perfect. There could and will be errors in this talk. I will be publishing slides in the short meta blog write-up of this talk on my blog, which is at stoic.dev. And if you've got any questions you can that can't be asked during the QA part, you can email me at rcfreetalk@stoic.dev. Just note that my AskMD is set up to drop any emails containing the phrase, "This is more of a comment." Yeah, and if you're a professional web developer, this can joining a union or starting a workers' council can also give you a better position to talk with your employer about accessibility measures you might want to implement. So that's a good idea. That's it for now, and yeah, my timing is not perfect, but yeah, we have lots of time for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the very interesting talk. You're right, we are now in the Q&A section, so our signal angel has been very, very hard at work to gather all the questions that you have posted. If you have any questions now, please put them now, either into the IRC channel, hashtag RC3-CWTV on the Hacken network, or use the hashtag RC3-CWTV, now without a dash, on any Twitter or Mastodon account you have, and our signal angel will hopefully pick them up. I'm very sorry about the microphone quality. You might have noticed that it's not up to what we wanted to have. Sadly, there was a technical issue at the end, and thanks to Jennifer for quickly fixing this. It was sadly the best that we could come up with on a short notice. I guess if people didn't understand the section but wanted to learn more, they could probably also send you an email. Is that right?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, a whole year of working in home office and now my headset stops working.
Yeah. that's a little bit bad, but sadly that's the situation that we have now with this whole pandemic thing going on. But what will you do? So, some questions have already been prepared. So, thank you to our signal angel. One very interesting question. How do screen readers handle modal overlays or similar features?
Depends on how you make them. So, a modal, which generally be a live region, that would probably also get the Aria Live assertive, because if a modal pops up, it usually takes the focus away from whatever someone's already reading. So you would add this Aria Live to it. And then, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. That's very interesting. And one, you did talk about buttons and using semantic HTML wherever possible. And there's one question about useful text on links and buttons. Is there any reasonable number of maximum characters on buttons or any other best practices there?
I don't know of any, to be honest, but yeah, like, if you've got a button that's 70 characters long or 75, like the line practice that I talked about, that's probably too much. The lowest amount of characters, there's actually an audit on the Lighthouse for that. So it's not about amount of characters, but about the size of the button, so that it is clickable on, even on mobile. So that will tell you if the buttons are too small.
Okay, so go to Google Lighthouse and see if Lighthouse screams at you, then you're probably doing it wrong. Not a guarantee, like I said, that is correct, but at least you know you're not especially wrong there. Okay, and one more question that I'll have to parse this a little bit. So one of the thing about accessibility seems to be that experts on web technology are much more preoccupied with themselves rather than like fixing the actual issue. So there's this question like this, holy, there can only be one H1 tag in a page. How do you think this relates in respect to accessibility, and what should a user of web technology in this case take from such like maybe elitist views? And do you know if there's a middle ground or something that they can stick to?
The thing with the H1 tag is that it's mostly because H1 just means that this is like a general heading for the entire page. So there may be a use case where you've got to have multiple. And I don't believe that any rules should always be followed without thinking about them. And all of these are just things that you should consider, but this is not a Bible and we're not fundamentalists. So especially if you're getting feedback, people saying that something is good or bad, then that's definitely more important than following rules. I hope this answers the question.
Mm-hmm. So in essence, again, put in your head and try to see if what you're doing makes sense and actually works on screen readers. This is probably the best advice for no hard rule to follow. Okay, cool. I think those are all the questions that our Signal Angel did collect. So it was a rather short Q&A, but you did show us a lot of details and a lot of interesting things about Aria. I did learn something myself, so hopefully all the other people watching learned something as well. And yeah, I want to thank you for your great talk.
Yeah, thank you for your time.